Hello and welcome back to the Journeyman Podcast with me, Mark Reeves.
And I'm Joseph Corlett. We travel from club to club around the world discussing the fascinating stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football teams all across the globe.
In this episode, we'll pick up from part one of our Blackpool story.
Just a recap from last time out, in 1987, a certain Mr. Oyston had just bought a stake in Blackpool Football Club.
As the club's on-field performance continued to stagnate, the number of people in the stands at Bloomfield Road hit an all-time low.
Throughout this period, attendances were dropping again, with only 1,900 fans witnessing the visit of Fulham on the 7th of April, a new and unwanted club record. The style of play was also now under fire, and the pressure to bring more success to the club was intensifying.
1,900 fans, like, it wasn't that long ago we were saying the press in the town were upset that there was only 30,000 now attending a game, so we're down to under 2,000 now.
It's a massive slide from where they were.
Yeah, so I think the rot has really set in now, and this is going to continue because in the back scenes, Owen Oyston, the local entrepreneur, was gaining a larger stake in the club now, and he was made chairman, succeeding Ken Chadwick in 1988. His ambitions and promises of a new stadium made headlines throughout much of the 90s.
However, one fan stated, "We've been promised more super stadiums than we can remember, and what we've got were two stands that are already starting to show their age. The ground looks awful."
Yeah, this is the weird thing, especially with Owen Oyston at first, is the fact he's technically saved Blackpool from financial ruin in 1988, but everything he's done after ruins that, definitely, doesn't it? And also, so he becomes chairman in 88 and has to step down a few years later in 1996 when he's convicted of rape. His son, Carl, took over and remained chairman until 2018. But obviously the Oystons seriously divide opinion, and we're going to come back to them in more detail.
Jumping into some random highlights from the 90s, like the 1991 visit of Tottenham Hotspur to Bloomfield Road for the FA Cup third round tie.
Terry Venables was the Tottenham manager at the time, and in his team at this point, the England trio, Gary Mabbott, Gary Lineker, who at this point has like 61 caps to his name, and a young 24-year-old Paul Gascoigne. The Londoners won by a single goal, which was actually scored by Paul Stewart, who was a former Blackpool striker. The £72,000 they got in gate receipts actually remains a club record.
A more stranger story throughout the 90s was during 1993, Blackpool hosted a buy-a-player league match hosted against Rotherham United. A scheme in which the money from the gate receipts was given directly to the manager to be spent specifically on players, and the crowd of 6,000 there paid for the purchase of Andy Watson.
It seems a strange concept, but also, why don't more clubs just market a buy-a-player match? Like,
I'm very surprised this hasn't been done before or done since.
It must be like quite a cool feeling for like a Blackpool fan to know, like, if you was in the crowd of 6,144 people, that your however much you paid to get in the stadium has helped buy Andy Watson. You earn, in effect, a bit of Andy Watson.
Prior to the start of the 1993 campaign, the club sold their tricky right winger Trevor Sinclair to QPR for a then club record of 600k. And during the same pre-season, Blackpool won the Lancashire Senior Cup, beating Manchester United by a single Brian Griffiths goal at Bloomfield Road.
Yeah, and this was Blackpool's first success in the Lancashire Senior Cup since 1953, that famous year that we've gone on about so much. The Manchester United team actually included a young 18-year-old David Beckham. But I found the match programme from this game, and out of all the players to have their names spelt wrong, David Beckham in the match programme, the team on the back, is actually referred to as Becklem D. But also in the Manchester United team, we've got Mick Phelan. I found it strange, I don't know why, I think of Mick Phelan as just this really old man, assistant manager, football manager, that his playing football career and David Beckham's football career like overlapped in the same team. I found it quite strange. Along with Gary Neville, a young Nicky Butt, Darren Ferguson, one of Fergie's sons, Keith Gillespie, Sheffield United legend, and Dion Dublin.
Dion, known infamously for his musical instrument, the Jube.
Yeah, and even better, his infamous "It's up the stairs to the bedrooms" line from Hands Under the Hammer. So. But yeah, he was also in the Manchester United team that was beaten by Blackpool, along with David Becklem.
At the end of the season, when the club survived relegation by the virtue of a final day victory at home to Leyton Orient, chairman Owen Oyston decided it was time for a change and sacked current manager Billy Eyre.
His replacement in July 1994 was Sam Allardyce.
Big Sam's ride at Blackpool started as he left arch rivals Preston to join the Seasiders. At Preston, he was part of the youth setup after a brief stint as caretaker manager. John Beck, however, got the full-time job, as Sam Allardyce felt there was a lot of friction between the two, noting in his autobiography, "I didn't like him and he didn't like me."
Classic Sam to the point. So yeah, in 1994, he joins a third division Blackpool team that's just survived relegation by 1 point. Not a lot of other people, I don't think, wanted this job. And Allardyce wasn't even given a proper contract, but he took the job anyway.
Big Sam set about trying to implement a whole host of new and interesting sports science and medicine changes that were new to England at the time. He had picked up the tips from observing American football in regards to how many support staff and roles they all had.
This is one thing maybe Allardyce doesn't get enough credit for, is that he actually introduced a lot of stuff to the game that we didn't have and we take for granted nowadays. He's one of the people that brought in the whole like sports performance stuff and watching clips back and things like this.
And one of his fellow coaches, Mark Taylor, states things as simple as pre-training, flexibility routines and nutrition were new things in England at the time. The finances weren't around to be able to cover everything he wanted to do.
The players at the time, like Mickey Mellon, who was his first signing at Blackpool, the current Dundee manager, and he spoke about his methods. He said that they were taking creatine and they were taking all the sort of sports drinks and shakes that other clubs didn't start for another 6 years or so. They're doing weight programs, individual programs for each player, video analysis. He said like they were doing all this stuff and he'd never come across it before.
Phil Brown, who was promoted to become Sam's longtime assistant after playing at Blackpool, states, "I remember the very first time we met on the training ground. He had a mindset of how we wanted to play and he was drilling us into an organised unit of 4-3-3. We were playing by just doing 11 versus 11 on a regular basis. It was his methodology more than anything else. He liked having a joke. He thought happy players were good players."
Phil Brown says like he had a way of recognising like the best way to get a message across to the players, and whether this was like, you know, shouting at them or letting them have a few beers, a meal, and finding people's strengths and weaknesses. And he says like whatever happened, he managed to get players to buy into his model and his way of playing.
Mark Taylor also goes on to state, "It was based around education. We would spend a lot of time speaking to the players before and after training, giving them feedback and research into how to make them better players, proving that the physical and tactical performances could be improved. Once the players could see that and experience it, it was quite easy for them to buy in."
I think the thing we've got to remember here, this is Allardyce's first full-time proper manager's job. He's a real innovator. Oliver Kerr, the journalist, had said when he interviewed him in sort of those early days, the things that stuck out to him is the fact like he was talking loads about sports science, recovery, rehabilitation. Apparently he even said to him, talking about how many entries we've had into the final third and crossing statistics, pass completion. Oliver Kerr says that he'd never even heard this spoke about in the Champions League or Premier League at the time. I think it's crazy that he's labelled as just this hoofball, old-fashioned guy you get in to maybe rescue a club in the season when he probably did bring a lot to English football.
Between the mixture of statistics and his man management style, Mickey Mellon goes on to say, "Management is about the group of players you have or the set of tools you have. What Big Sam has always been able to do is to look around the room and see what he is available to him and work out a way of getting clean sheets and winning football games."
What I found really fascinating, an interview I listened to with Sam Allardyce. He speaks about using these statistics and like these newfound things in the 1990-2000 season. And he's saying if he used statistical analysis then you could gain 5-10% in terms of performance because nobody else used it, so it wasn't a marginal gain, it was huge.
With the first season under Sam at the club saw the team finish in a stable 12th place and pushed on to become promotion contenders in the next season.
Yeah, and after a spell at the top of the table they finished third, missing out on promotion by a single point. These really small lines between relegations and promotions. It was still though their highest league finish in over a decade.
They lost out in the playoff semi-final, losing 3-2 to Bradford over two legs, and this was seen as not good enough by Owen Oyston. Oyston was currently serving the jail sentence for rape and indecent assault at the time, and from his prison cell decreed that the season's achievements were not good enough, and in fact led to Big Sam's sacking.
Allardyce is essentially sacked from a jail cell. Big Sam actually later reflected on his career at Blackpool, and he says, "It tells you there can be no loyalty. It works in both ways, and that's what it taught me. The experience at Blackpool gave me a big insight into the ruthlessness of football if you're a manager." And it's quite ironic in a way that he goes on to multiple other clubs with what we could call dodgy owners. Goes on Newcastle with Mike Ashley and Blackburn with the Venkies, of course.
Sometimes it doesn't matter how much time or how much effort or what you do at a football club. Within a short space of time, your time can be up, Sam Allardyce decrees.
But you can't not love Sam's attitude, and especially a great quote from like when he was speaking about how much he used to love to beat Jose Mourinho, like in that peak Chelsea sort of 05 team. Great quote where he says, "He can tell me all he likes. I don't give a shite. I love to see Chelsea players moaning at the referee trying to intimidate him. Jose jumping up and down on the touchline saying we're playing crap football. It's brilliant to get a result against him. I love Jose."
He was just as brutal inside the changing room as he was in the press conference with Vince Grella, Blackburn Australian midfielder, saying when he has to be, he could be a ruthless bastard. He's a very strong man. He knows what he wants. And if you're not on board, you're out the door. When he's in charge, he's in charge. I like that as well. There's an authority there. Plus, he's a big fucking man. And when he talks, the walls fucking shake. And if he gets pissed, you'd better be careful.
It's a great quote from Vince Grella.
After Big Sam left the club, followed a period of mediocrity for the Seasiders that was only fixed once the departure of Colin Hendry was replaced by caretaker manager Simon Grayson for the first team in November of 2005.
He managed to save Blackpool from relegation and therefore he's given the job on a permanent basis for the start of the 06-07 season, which turned out to be one of Blackpool's most successful for quite a long time.
In the latter stages of the 2006 season, he led Blackpool to only one defeat in the last 14 league games, a sequence that included 5 wins out of 6, resulting in their appearance in the playoff positions. The run also brought fans back to the stadiums, with 7,000 appearing at Bloomfield Road. This led to Grayson being awarded Manager of the Month for December.
By the time you get to the end of the season, Grayson's guided Blackpool to a final finishing position of third place, therefore a place in the playoffs. Blackpool faced Oldham Athletic in the semi-finals, which they went on to win 5-2 on aggregate. And then they met Yeovil Town in the final at the newly renovated Wembley Stadium on the 27th of May.
They secured promotion to the Championship with a 2-0 win. It was their 10th consecutive victory at a new club record.
Yeah, and in that team, what I found quite amusing on the team sheet is Blackpool actually had a Robbie Williams and a Michael Jackson, and there's some fantastic commentary on Robbie Williams' goal in the final, actually, with Robbie Williams, "Let me entertain you."
Future members of the Premier League promotion team featured that day, like Paul Rushupka, Ian Everett and Keith Southern.
Yeah, and the second goal in that final was scored by Keegan Parker, who went on to have an absolute textbook journeyman career. Before that, prolific for Blackpool. Before the game, he'd sold his own kiss-and-tell story of a relationship with Jade Goody to a tabloid. And a week before a derby game with Preston, he'd been fined £275 after he smashed the glass door of a Blackpool massage parlour at 4 a.m, having been told to leave Desires when he threw his bag of chips at one of the girls working there.
However, Parker, talking about the goal he scored in the final, stated, "It's the best day of my career. I've scored against Celtic and Rangers before, but to win at Wembley is something I'll treasure for the rest of my life."
So Blackpool would take part in the Championship next season, would finish in 19th place, just avoiding relegation. Grayson, after the work he'd done getting the team promoted and cementing their place in the Championship, was being linked with various managerial jobs, but most strongly with the job at Leeds United, which is where he actually started his playing career. Following the dismissal of Gary McAllister in December 2008, Leeds had approached Blackpool to speak to Grayson, which they refused.
Despite this, Grayson tendered his resignation, which the Blackpool board did not accept. However, he was announced as Leeds United's new manager, and the two clubs ultimately settled the dispute for an undisclosed fee.
And Grayson would go on to manage local rivals Preston North End before returning to Blackpool a few years later.
I'm not particularly sure that Grayson is held in high regard amongst Blackpool fans, considering most modern videos where Grayson features in things like press conferences, the comments section is full of things like Grayson out. And I think if you're going to manage Preston and like leave the club for Leeds and then also manage Fleetwood Town, it seems like a very weird career move.
He sort of soured his success in a way, in like the manner that he left the club.
Now the Blackpool fans come to life. They sense this might be a big moment here just before half time. It is Robbie Williams. Oh yes, Robbie Williams, let me entertain you.
On the 21st of May 2009, Ian Holloway was appointed as manager of Blackpool Football Club. He signed a one-year contract with the club. Club president Valerie Bellicon declared he had set up a new transfer fund in which he had added a considerable amount of money in order for Holloway to invest in new players.
Yeah, and 4 days later, Blackpool broke their transfer record by signing Charlie Adam from Scottish champions Rangers for £500,000. Charlie Adam actually speaks about the fact that it was Bellicon who put the money up rather than the Oystons. And he said, "Valerie put his money there and he stumped up a lot of money over the years. Fortunately for me, he did what he felt was right for the football club." And I think the impression I've got anyway is that Bellicon was sold a dream by the Oystons and perhaps conned in the same way that the Oystons have managed to con the fans in a way. He was also ripped off and owed a lot of money, which we'll speak about soon. But I think Bellicon's intentions were good, I think, for the club.
Yeah, you could definitely say that as prior to the Adams deal, Blackpool's transfer record was just £275,000 for Chris Malkin from Millwall in 1996.
For a resurgent and strong finish to the season, winning 9 of their last 10 games. Blackpool found themselves hosting Bristol City on the final league game of the season with a chance of the playoffs. They needed to better or match Swansea City's result in their match at home to Doncaster. Both the games ended in draws. Swansea's Lee Trundle had a late goal disallowed for handball, which meant Blackpool secured the remaining playoff spot. This was the first time they'd actually been in the top six all season. There's always one team in the Championship that does this, like late on in the season, has this great run and has a run for the playoffs, and this was obviously Blackpool's year. Imagine if that Lee Trundle goal had counted. This is before goal line technology as well.
A true smash and grab to get themselves into the top six at the right time. Their sixth place finish, in fact, was the highest ranking in the Football League since the 1970s. And DJ Campbell went on to say about the promotion push, "To be honest, we were doing okay throughout the season. It was towards the end of the year when we started winning every week. We started on a 3-game run, then a 4, then a 5, and when we did, that was when we were just below the playoffs."
The thing that we picked up on from multiple members of that promotion-winning squad is like the atmosphere and the camaraderie the team had. There's a great story from Charlie Adam on the bus back from an away win at Plymouth, obviously a very long bus journey back. And he says that Ollie, about 10 minutes into the journey, stopped the bus and he said, "Right lads, get in that shop and fill yourself with alcohol, we're going to enjoy this." So everyone gets off the bus, gets themselves a crate of beer, straight back on, and they end up at a fish and chip place later on. And all the lads are just drinking, having beers. And Charlie says, "The team spirit was brilliant, and that Plymouth game really reminds me of it. The lads were doing vodka shots, vodka cokes and all that. It was a brilliant long journey coming back, and the manager loved it as well." I bet you did, Ian.
I could imagine him feisty as hell on the back of the bus.
Holloway on some vodka cokes.
On the back of this magnificent run, Blackpool met Nottingham Forest, who they'd already beaten twice in that season in the semi-finals of the playoffs. Charlie Adams stated, "We are delighted when we got them in the playoffs because we knew we could beat them over two legs. We said to ourselves, as long as we get Forest in the semi-finals, we'll take anyone else on in the final."
In the first leg, Blackpool beat Nottingham Forest 2-1 at Bloomfield Road. Going into the second leg, Forest hadn't actually conceded a goal for over 12 hours at home.
Davies' side won 18 games at the City Ground on the way to finishing third, a figure only matched by Newcastle as they romped to a title with 102 points.
Yeah, so 3 days after the first leg, Blackpool beat Forest 4-3, 6-4 in aggregate, and progressed to the final. This is actually their third playoff final in 10 seasons. So you could say there's a real resurgence going on here. The highlight of this game, of course, is DJ Campbell's hat-trick, his first for the club. He actually hits the bar later on as well. I could have had another one. But this actually meant Blackpool had beaten Forest in all four of their club's meetings in the 09-10 season.
DJ Campbell spoke about that second leg, saying, "Under Ollie, we could attack, attack, attack. We knew we could score. It was, can we outscore them, basically?"
And there's some great interviews with the Nottingham Forest players at the time as well, James Perch saying how fluid Blackpool were up top, like the front three changing round, that DJ Campbell was on his side, who got a hat-trick, which doesn't bode too well. A really good quote from Guy Moosey, who talks about the momentum of the team who miss out on automatic promotion and have another month of working hard, going again for the playoffs. It's so different to what Blackpool had, and he's saying Nottingham Forest were basically like, "Fucking hell, we've just lost promotion. Basically, we've got to pick ourselves up and go again." Whereas Blackpool are riding this crazy wave we spoke about, winning like 10 games or something, like completely different mentality.
This game lives long in the memory for many Blackpool fans, as quoted from the presenter of the Seasiders podcast stating, "When we have guests on, it's a question we ask, what's your most memorable Blackpool game? And 95 of them say that game."
Stephen Dobby, who played that day for Blackpool, goes on to win promotion in the final. Actually comes back to haunt Forest again a year later when he's back at his parent club Swansea, and they also beat Forest, and he becomes a back-to-back playoff winner. Just to rub salt in the wounds there.
Dobby again. DJ Campbell. Dobby. DJ Campbell. That's another one. Blackpool surely on their way to Wembley now. It's been a superb performance this by Blackpool. Dobby. It's going to be another.
This set up the biggest game in Blackpool's history since the 53 final against Cardiff. Both teams were the top scorers in the Championship, and promotion would be worth over £90 million.
Jimmy Armfield, the legend Mr. Blackpool, was in the stands along with 82 of the 1,000 fans. It was a crazy game, wasn't it?
It's red hot. All the players are looking sweltering under the summer heat at Wembley, And it's just a crazy first half with Cardiff taking the lead twice.
Both times when Cardiff took the lead, Blackpool immediately equalised within 4 minutes each time. And there's some great interviews with Holloway and with the players about the tactics they used and how they planned to beat this Cardiff team. It's a very good Cardiff team.
However, they devised a plan playing their 4-3-3 all season, which defensively would fall into a 4-5-1. Ian Holloway talks about the plan, stating, if the opposition attacked down one side, we'd ask the opposite winger to stay up and wide and play cat and mouse, like a seesaw effect. It's the only game in my entire career where I focus 100% on us, and I believe we could outscore them. I could have put down a more defensive structure, but I didn't believe we could stop Cardiff's quality with Chopra, Boothroyd, Whittingham, Ledley and Burke.
The Blackpool team seemed quite confident that Boothroyd and Chopra wouldn't work back, and this was something they could really exploit with their fullbacks being so high. So Holloway was determined they wasn't going to change their game plan. This is the one time, like you say, he was thinking completely about his own team, about this Blackpool side and how they could expose the Cardiff team.
Calling back to that 53 final, DJ Campbell in fact channeled his inner Mortensen, saying, Seamus Coleman said to me on the coach, you're never nervous. Are you not nervous? I was like, nah, why would we be nervous? We got to embrace these times because our careers are very short. And so when we have the opportunity to play in these games, we've got to make sure we grab it.
So much confidence, just like the man Morty himself. A thing I found really interesting is how, despite playing with this front three, Holloway wanted all three of them, like Ormerod, Taylor Fletcher, DJ Campbell, to play as strikers, and they were all strikers for him, and they should just think, you are a forward but you're playing out wide rather than your winger, and he wanted them to interchange, which is something we see a lot in, you know, more recent football, but I feel it's quite new for this point, and obviously Cardiff couldn't deal with this.
Ian Holloway goes on to state that they'd worked on switching the ball quickly. If you could get onto one side of the pitch, Cardiff would shuffle over their numbers across, but we would be brave and switch back to the opposite fullback. This would cause Blackpool to outnumber them on the opposite side, and that was how we did it. On the day, we probably played too many long diagonals as we go a goal down another, but I knew we could keep going and we could keep motoring. All we spoke about was that they're going to be narrow. One of their players isn't going to work back, so we can outnumber them.
This comes back to the point about Boothroyd, where they're saying they're confident he wasn't going to be working back, so they're sort of playing with a four and a four, coming in quite narrow, because Burke being the only real winger in that team, Whittingham is playing in the centre. So it's leaving a lot of room around for Taylor Fletcher and Ormerod.
And this can be seen as Brett Ormerod comes inside for the third goal. Holloway continues, they did it together. They did it with the movement.
With the free kick from Adam and a goal from Gary Taylor Fletcher and Brett Ormerod, Blackpool were promoted to the Premier League. Blackpool had now uniquely been promoted through all three tiers of the Football League via the playoff system.
Considering it was 28 degrees on the day of the playoff final, at the end of a long championship season, it was a very brave and bold decision to play in such a high-paced attacking way.
There's some great quotes from Holloway about how he spoke to his team before this game and how he asked them to achieve what they did achieve. A great one, which ties back to everything we've been talking about today, is when he says, the biggest thing you got them to understand, like with Stanley Matthews all over the wall, Morty all over the walls, why can't this be you? Like, why can't Blackpool fans be remembering you, Gary Taylor Fletcher, you, Brett Ormerod, in 40, 50 years' time in the same light as that 53 Cup final team?
One gem of a comment that we found was, Jesus satisfied 5,000 with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Ian Holloway satisfied millions with 11 tangerines.
Well, he certainly did, because it was evidence in the promotion parade that was held along the promenade in Blackpool. They travelled along on an open topper from Glynn Square down the Golden Mile to the Waterloo Headland, with 100,000 people lining the route. At the Headland, Holloway and the squad took to the stage to address the gathered mass crowd. This is the most unbelievable moment of my life. I've jumped on the best ride of my life and I don't want to go home. It's a very fitting quote for Blackpool with roller coasters, and he was on one hell of a roller coaster ride here, hasn't he?
Charlie Adams spoke about Holloway's promotion speech to the players, saying, it won't be until maybe 10, 15 years later you'll realise what you've achieved. Maybe when you retire and people are asking you to talk about a game like this. Like the lads that won the FA Cup and the promotions, I want you to be those people that are still talked about in 20 years' time.
I think they're definitely, all of those players that played a part in that team sealed their status as club legends. And like, this is a Blackpool team that narrowly avoided relegation to League One the season before.
And now they're taking 37,000 fans to Wembley.
Well, yeah, which is the quirk of the final, where apparently this is the most Blackpool fans that have ever been in one stadium. Because in the 53 final, the tickets were given out across the country. So maybe there was about 20,000 max fans there. So yeah, this is the most tangerines that have ever been in one stadium together.
I mentioned a moment ago that Vaughan has a useful left foot, but Charlie Adam can probably see him and raise him. 17 goals this season, Charlie Adam.
And here he is, sizing it up at Wembley Stadium. Adam strikes it well. Oh, he strikes it absolutely beautifully. Charlie Adam, the £500,000 signing in the richest game of football, with a wonderful strike. Out comes Jilks.
Listen to that roar. Listen to that roar to our right. And that's the reason why.
40 years since Blackpool were last promoted to the top flight. And they have done it again. Blackpool are in the Premier League. And there are many inhabitants of that town that never thought they would hear that.
And here we arrive for Blackpool's first appearance in the Premier League since its founding in 1992. Its first appearance in English top flight in 39 years.
Yeah, so like the last time Blackpool played against the big names of English football, like regularly in a league competition, you could actually buy a house for about £5,000. It shows how long ago it was.
As a consequence of winning promotion, Blackpool's Bloomfield Road Stadium, which had a capacity of 16,750, became one of the smallest stadiums to host Premier League football. The talk during the build-up to the new season was mainly centred around the club's lack of activity in the transfer market.
Traditionally, you say, like, when you get promoted to the Premier League, you need to sign players with the Premier League experience, like one in each position, maybe a forward, midfielder, defender, goalkeeper, and there's not a lot there, is he? Like, Malon Harewood is a good signing on a free transfer. DJ Campbell made his move permanent, but, you know, when you look at the rest of the signings, the three sort of random French players, obviously Grandin would go on to be quite successful, but Ludovic Silvestre, Mallory Martin, it doesn't bode too well, does it?
It doesn't scream Premier League quality.
No. And this is no disrespect to some of these players, like Chris Basham, the good little player. Craig Cathcart did well this season, ex-Man United youngster. But yeah, it's not £90 million. Well, you can't see any investment there, can you?
However, Holloway tried to overcome these problems, stating how he wants to play in the Premier League. For me, we have to try and attack and attack and attack and keep on attacking, because I believe that's how you should play football.
That was evident, obviously, through the whole Championship season, but also in the transfer activity itself. It was already a very top-heavy team, I would say, in terms of forwards. And the fact you've added Grandin, Harewood, Varney, Phillips, Campbell, who are all attacking players, he definitely was sticking by his morals, I think. And everybody who was a neutral during this Premier League season can stick by that. Like, what an amazing spectacle Blackpool put on.
However, Holloway was under no illusions, stating, "I know I want to do, and we'll probably get whooped, because they've got such an advantage over us with all that wedge they've had for years. But my lot, we're going to get better grass, a better training ground, and these boys deserve a chance, and that's what they'll get from me." End of story.
I love the use of wedge. I love that quote, but also it's so sad at the same time. Like, I love it because it's Holloway, he's sticking to his guns, he's saying he wants to play this football, he'll reward these lads who's got in there. But at the same time, when he's talking about getting the better training ground, getting the better grass, it's quite sad that we know, like, he doesn't ever get that. And basically every Blackpool manager has been asking for that since, like, the 60s. The media predictions ahead of Blackpool's first ever Premier League match were of a swift return to the Championship. However, Blackpool defeated Wigan Athletic 4-0 at the DW Stadium. Two goals from Malon Harewood and one from Gary Taylor-Fletcher and Alex Baptiste saw Blackpool sit top of the table until Chelsea's 6-0 victory over West Brom later in the day. It was the first time they'd been in such a position since they won their opening game of the 57-58 top flight campaign.
It was their first away win in the top flight since beating Newcastle on the 29th of August in 1970. Apart from Craig Cathcart, Malon Harewood and Elliot Grandin, all the players that started the match played for Blackpool in the Championship season before.
Which, a mixture of Holloway sticking to his guns and rewarding the lads that got him there, like you said, but also that lack of investment maybe that we spoke about earlier. Gary Taylor-Fletcher, I feel, let's put some respect on this man's name. He's someone who has been in and around the Football League his whole career, but he achieved some great milestones in his career, didn't he?
Throughout his journey around the English pyramid, he scored in the top six divisions. He netted the 500,000th Football League goal, found the net in the playoff final that sent Blackpool to the Premier League for the first time, and then hit the club's first Premier League goal.
He's someone that maybe didn't get the respect he deserved when you talk about what he actually achieved. He was actually released by Liverpool at a young age, and he says, like, for him to go on and play in the Premier League when he was told by Liverpool that he'd never play professionally, you just think back, like, what he's achieved, you just couldn't imagine it, could you really?
He goes on to state, "I don't care what people say anymore. I played in the top six leagues, including the Conference South. It is a magnificent career, and all those fans that have slated me, they have done nothing like that.
Yeah, and I think he got a lot of abuse about his physique and things, but the guy's banging him in all six divisions in England. Like, come back when you can do that sort of thing.
It's great to see a player giving it back sometimes, I think.
Especially Gary Taylor Fletcher, who also, throughout this Premier League season, pops up with some massive goals in big games as well.
Holloway stated after the emphatic 4-0 win, "I think I'll take a photo of it, the league table, and retire now because that'll be the highest we'll be all year. We've got to find three teams to finish above. That's reality. It's been such a horrible summer."
Referring to how few players he's been able to bring in. He says about like Malin Harewood, who got, like we said, two goals on his debut on Blackpool's first game of the season. He says that Malin Harewood sums it up. He even had to come in on trial. Little Blackpool asking him, Malin Harewood, to come on trial, and he did. And he said it proves that he's a great lad and that he wanted to come there. The best part of this interview is when he speaks about their next fixture, which is away at Arsenal. He says, "We're going to the Emirates, which is probably one of the best stadiums in the world, and I just hope we don't get absolutely embarrassed, because that could quite easily happen."
The opening day win was immediately followed by a 6-0 away loss at the hands of Arsenal.
Ouch. These first two games have both been away due to stuff with the stand and relaying the pitch. So the first ever home Premier League game at Bloomfield Road took place 1 week after the Arsenal loss, which ended in a 2-2 draw against Fulham.
What a day it has been. Blackpool fans, take a look at the top of the table. Oh, look at that. Absolutely marvellous. First time in the top flight since 1971. And they are top of the Premier League today after a 4-0 win at Wigan. It's 53 years since that's happened that they've been top of the top flight. Should we just leave it there for a moment or two?
However, one of the first major highlights of this Premier League season was going away to Anfield and beating Liverpool. On the 3rd of October of 2010, Liverpool were sitting in the bottom three of the league for the first time since the mid-80s, and a joyful Blackpool side blended work rate and commitment with some slick passing to celebrate a first win at Anfield since 1967.
Yeah, they achieved victory through a Charlie Adam penalty and a Luke Varney goal, which put them 2-0 up at half-time. Sotiros Kyriakos, do you remember him? He scored a header to give the home side hope, and he nearly scored an equaliser in injury time, but there's a great save from Matt Gilkes. So this sealed a famous victory for Blackpool. It continued Liverpool's absolute nightmare start to the season, which also saw them dumped out of the Carling Cup against Northampton. But Blackpool's first Premier League season wasn't without controversy.
On the 27th of January, the Premier League fined Blackpool £25,000 for fielding what they believed to be a weakened team against Aston Villa in November. Ian Holloway initially threatened to resign if the punishment was dealt, making 10 changes to the squad for that fixture.
Six of those players, including Jason Yule, who captained the team, were all making their first Premier League starts of the season. Charlie Adam and DJ Campbell, the top scorers, are both on the bench. But I remember at the time, I felt really strongly about this. I don't know what your opinion is. But at the time, I felt the FA, the Premier League, at the start of the season, say you can name a squad of 25 players, and with those 25 players, it's up to the manager to use them how he sees fit. I could understand if he was playing like young players that you don't have to register, but like he's playing his 25 registered players. Like,
I'd have to agree with you. I think it's ridiculous personally. I think if you've registered a squad, you can use what players you like. I wouldn't even agree with what you said with the youngster players. If Ian Holloway wants to play 11 players, let him. I don't think it's on the Premier League's heads to judge what a team does.
Yeah, and after the game, before Holloway knows the FA are looking into it, he says about to make 10 changes might have looked crazy, but they've got 4 games in 12 days and he was struggling to keep the players fit. I just think it's really harsh. And the fact that the club didn't dare appeal the decision, because if they appealed and lost the decision, they could lose points, which of course, when you're trying to survive in the Premier League,
every point's up for grabs.
Yeah.
Jumping into their second major highlight of this amazing season, they did the double over Liverpool, beating them at Bloomfield Road. On a cold January night, Kenny Dalglish was managing his first Premier League match as manager in 12 years. Liverpool took the lead through an early Fernando Torres goal. However, Gary Taylor Fletcher pegged them back, equalising soon after for the Seasiders. DJ Campbell took advantage of some woeful defending and handed Blackpool the victory after he was left alone to nod in the six-yard area.
Yeah, so Blackpool achieved their first double over Liverpool since the 46-47 season. But more significantly, they leapfrogged their opponents in the table with a game in hand. DJ Campbell spoke about Blackpool's underdog status and he said they wasn't meant to be there in people's eyes, and so-called little club, and having to compete against these, you know, these big, world-renowned teams with players that came from non-league, a lot of them, and Charlie Adam from Scotland, saying like nobody had heard of Matty Phillips, Baptiste, Matt Gilkes, David Vaughan. before this Blackpool season, and a few of those as well, like David Vaughan goes on to have a decent Premier League career at Sunderland, Matt Phillips still playing the Premier League now for West Brom, like seriously overachieved, a proper plucky underdog.
They came close to getting big results against Manchester City, losing 3-2, unfortunate, to a crazy game which saw four goals in the last 12 minutes. They were close to getting a result against Manchester United at Bloomfield Road. However, Man United pegged them back with three goals in the 72nd, 74th and 88th minutes. Berbatov and Hernandez doing the damage. However, they managed to get a massive win against Spurs in the February of that year.
Goals from Adam again, of course. Didier Campbell and Brett Ormerod. Interestingly, Tottenham had beaten AC Milan the week before. And even the one goal that Spurs had was like a 90 plus three consolation goal. Roman Pavlyuchenko, do you remember him?
What a name.
Yeah, Football Manager legend. Had a shot deflected in off Craig Cathcart. Blackpool actually started this match only 2 points above the relegation zone. And this win propelled them right up to mid-table. Holloway just doing Holloway things. Great quote. Does that make us better than AC Milan? I don't think so, but it does make up for some of the things that have happened recently, I think, referencing the whole Aston Villa fining. One downside to this result, which I think seriously impacted the team, is that Charlie Adam received a booking which would rule him out the next two games, one of which was against Wolves, fellow relegation candidates, which they then lost 4-0. Unfortunately, after this win against Tottenham, Blackpool would actually only go on to win one more game during the season.
Quoted from a BBC match reporter from the time, Ian Holloway's side have modelled their approach on attacking football, regardless of their opponent. It is a philosophy that makes them a major threat at one end, but very vulnerable at the other.
After like watching many of Blackpool's games that season, because they were so entertaining to watch, like this is very accurate. Like they were great going forward and fearless, and it was so exciting to watch. But yeah, at the other end, very vulnerable to conceding goals.
The penultimate match of this amazing season was against local Lancashire rivals Bolton Wanderers. A truly superb game that resulted in a 4-3 win for Blackpool. The game was one of the finest of this or indeed any Premier League season. It was testimony to Ian's style, and for better or for worse, the victory was a reward for his players' dedication to it.
Yeah, another one. 3-2 at half-time, which seems to be a regular occurrence for Blackpool under Holloway. Two from Campbell and a goal from Jason Puncheon. Kevin Davis and Matty Taylor scoring for Bolton. In the second half, Danny Sturridge actually equalises, who was on loan from Chelsea. And Charlie Adam scored what would prove to be the winner in the 63rd minute. Adam poured forward and found Taylor Fletcher, who held up the ball on the edge of the area before returning the ball to his captain to lash it into the roof from 15 yards, sending the home fans into raptures.
After this amazing result, they set up an intense final day situation for Blackpool.
With five clubs fighting to secure the Premier League status, it was actually branded as Survival Sunday. So the league table after that win against Bolton had Blackpool in 18th position. They played 37 games on 39 points. Ahead of them, there was Birmingham on 39 points, Wolves on 40, and Blackburn on 40. And it just so happened that Blackpool's final game of the season was against recently crowned champions Manchester United.
Going away to Old Trafford, Ian Holloway knew only 3 points would give Blackpool a realistic chance of survival amid the dramatic twists and turns of the final day of the campaign.
This United team had only dropped 2 points at home all season, so it's quite the task to go there and knowing you have to win to stay in the Premier League.
However, Blackpool put up a good fight with goals from Charlie Adam and Gary Taylor-Fletcher, turning around an early deficit after Parchi Sun put United ahead.
The Tangerines looked on course to navigate an unlikely path to survival. Sadly for Holloway, his players, and the thousands of Blackpool supporters who travelled in hoping of an escape, United ruthlessly punished the Seasiders in the closing stages.
This condemned them to relegation with West Ham United and Birmingham City. Full-time 4-2, Park, Anderson, and Everett own goal, and Michael Owen doing the damage.
Blackpool's journey has been characterised by an all-out attacking philosophy, and Holloway stayed true to his principles to the end, but it was to no avail as they returned to the Championship exactly a year to the day that they won promotion. It's from a BBC article. It was a day of contrasting emotions, and you couldn't get a clearer picture of this than the reactions of both the teams at full-time. You've got a Blackpool team who were so dejected and gutted, making their way over to the travelling fans after, you know, putting up a great fight and being so close, like coming back from a goal down against this Man United team. By the way, this Manchester United team, they just won the league and they had the Champions League final in a few days, but Fergie did not play a weakened team at all. It was a very strong team. It was Van der Sar's last game. And yeah, so the United collect the trophy and they're looking forward to the Champions League final on Saturday, and the Blackpool players are just utterly dejected.
Blackpool attacked until the last moments of their top flight existence and went out on their shields with an Old Trafford standing ovation accompanying them.
give credit where it's due to the Man United fans, although I don't know whether it maybe felt a bit patronising and was no comfort to Blackpool fans, but they gave them a standing ovation to appreciate, like, you know, this team turned up at Old Trafford and attacked like folk, basically.
Ian Holloway summed up the final day, stating, "She, the fat lady, has put down her microphone. She's finished singing, and I don't like the tune. It's devastating." Classic Holloway.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it? Yeah, and the Guardian said, "For Blackpool, the adventure is over, but it will scarcely ease the hurt that they will be missed." It'd be easy to attack this team and say it was maybe naive from Holloway, like the way they played, like coming up to the Premier League, playing as attacking as they did and perhaps leaving themselves a bit open. But, you know, that's what made them great. That's what makes them stick in your memory, I think.
Charlie Adam goes on to speak about this naivety in the Premier League season, saying, "It's easy to say, looking back, that we were far too naive at times, far too open. If we were a little bit more experienced in the team or had more Premier League experience, we may have seen games out. We were 2-0 up at Blackburn and at Bolton. That would have kept us up. We drew 1-1 versus Wolves at home when we should have won."
What you've touched upon there, it comes back to what we're speaking about at the start of the season, the lack of bringing in this Premier League experience, a lack of investment. Like in January, Holloway brought in one player on loan and two free transfers. So you could say partly that, but also the fact that they dropped points to so many teams around them. Like, and you've got your local rivals, Blackburn and Bolton, in there, but drawing 1-1 with Wolves, getting hammered 4-0, and this really affected them at the end of the season. If they just got one more win in there, they'd have been safe. Holloway's, the style he played this season would go on to influence his former players, which obviously would in turn become managers. And it's quite interesting that Ian Everett, the central defender during the Premier League season, would go on to be a manager. And he's now Bolton manager, actually. And he says that all of his football philosophy, he just owes it all to Holloway and this Blackpool team that won promotion and played in the Premier League. And saying how Holloway came in and changed the mentality of the club, and he wouldn't accept that Blackpool were happy to stay in the Championship. He wouldn't want the players to accept that.
Ian Everett goes on to say about Ian Holloway, saying, "I have so much respect for him as a manager and as a man. What he gave that group of players at Blackpool was magnificent, and he played a huge part in helping to educate me in becoming a modern-day manager. I'm eternally grateful for him for that."
Thomas Ince has set off. Ince. Into the second half, Thomas Ince against West Ham. Would you believe that?
After relegation, the Seasiders went on to match the heroics in the Premier League with a massive effort in the Championship, getting themselves all the way up into the playoff positions at the first time of asking under Ian Holloway's tutelage.
Sadly, they've gone to lose their second playoff final in 3 years, 2-1 to West Ham, to remain in the Championship for another year.
We were lucky enough to get the perspective of Blackpool fan Ash, as he fondly remembers a away trip down to Millwall in the summer of 2012.
Yeah, the last game of the season, and he says about how their playoff position was already confirmed. They were just trying to finish higher to be able to play their semi-final leg at home. And he says the game ended 2-2, but that's why it's quite strange that he picks this out as one of his favourite games. he talks about like glorious weather in April, end-to-end game, attacking football, and he said that this just stood for everything that Holloway believed in. And the other interesting thing is a young 18-year-old that was playing for Millwall.
It was Harry Kane on loan from Spurs, and he ended up going on to score the equaliser in that 2-2 game. And even Ash goes on to say that he said to his mate before the equaliser went in that he'll become a Premier League player. So Ash has clearly got an eye for talent here.
It's like Joe Smith earlier on there.
Definitely. Hearing these stories when we're all starved of travelling to football matches or any form of going to matches has just got me feeling very nostalgic for sun-soaked away days and beers in the sun with your friends while you watch some lads play football.
Yeah, but unfortunately, so after nearly returning to the Premier League at the first attempt, the years that now follow would mark quite a sharp decline for the club.
This is where the Oystons really start to firmly grasp the club in with their money-grubbing ways.
As we touched upon earlier, the Oyston family had been in charge of Blackpool since like the late 80s. I think it'd be fair to say already that Owen Oyston is a bit of a chancer and talks quite a bit of shit. But one thing I think he outdoes himself is when in 1996, he actually says that he had the opportunity to buy a controlling interest in Manchester United, but he wasn't prepared to relinquish the family's interest in Blackpool.
Stating, after discussing the matter with the Football League, it was apparent they would not consider any formula in which would have me owning both clubs, which just...
The phrase no shit comes to mind as well. Like, how long has that been a rule for? Just to think the Man United fans moan about the Glazers, don't they?
Exactly.
Just the Oystons.
Who would be worse? The Glazers or Owen Oyston? Get in touch. Owen Oyster made his first public appearance at Bloomfield Road since his release from prison in February of 2002, opening up two new stands at Bloomfield Road.
Yeah, and on his return, I think we could even play a game of Oyston bullshit bingo here, because we've got another good one. So on his return, Oyston set about ambitious plans to turn Bloomfield Road into what he called a £1 billion super stadium with shops, restaurants and a hotel.
This was all expected to begin during the demolition of the South Stand in 2003, yet 3 years later, nothing had changed, obviously.
Apart from the demolition part, which left the club with a two-sided stadium and a temporary away end, and the term temporary, you can use it quite loosely, as this away stand wasn't disposed of until they actually Blackpool got into the Premier League in 2010.
Owen Oyston was instrumental in bringing in Latvian businessman Valery Belkanon to invest in the club in 2006, who we've already spoke about loosely. The story goes that Valery was at the club to strike up a simple sponsorship deal and left with a healthy stake in the club on the same day.
Yeah, I think this goes back to what we were sort of talking about before, where it seems Belkanon was tricked, fooled, I don't know, lured into like buying more of the club. And
this was one of the root causes of the problems, not Valery's investment, which ultimately led to the turnaround in fortunes at Bloomfield Road, but Owen and now Carl Oyston's ability to convince those who ought not to be convinced that good things were coming back to the Seasiders.
So like the new South Stand was built basically with Belkanon's money. Charlie Adam was signed with his money. He wasn't the bad guy in this situation, but was sort of duped by the bad guys, I think.
In and amongst this chaotic atmosphere, Ian Holloway vowed to never hold another training session in what he called the hellhole facilities at Squires Gate, which the club trained at.
To give you an idea of just how bad it was, there was literally a couple of porter cabins, a rusty clubhouse, no hot water, and just two pitches. Not even fit for non-league teams, let alone the second tier of English football. And this is a common theme that we spoke about, going all the way back to the 60s, 70s. The state of the facilities at Blackpool and the desperation, this need for investment and someone to actually improve the facilities at the club.
Carl Oyston once again comes out pledging that he's going to create a new training complex, which to this day is it's exactly the same.
Yeah, I'd say that's another bullshit bingo.
Ian Holloway even had to take his players to train on the beach before a vital home game against Manchester United because of the lack of indoor facilities after the training ground froze over, while the Bloomfield Road home dressing room boiler broke and was not fixed for 2 weeks.
It's the kind of stuff you imagine how like your landlord is in a student house, not like the owner of a football club, isn't it?
This feels like proper Sunday League levels of like disarray, and they're challenging against Man United in the Premier League in some of these stories.
But even Sunday League facilities aren't this bad.
You would think these type of headlines would be the climax for any normal club, the likes of Leeds United, but no, Blackpool, it was just getting started in their free fall.
You've got to think, like, this is a club with now like has a lot of money in it, from like the Premier League TV money, the parachute payments. They haven't been spending a lot of money on wages while they're in the Premier League, so the big question is, where is all the money going?
Charlie Adam even took the club to court over an unpaid promotion bonus, which the rest of the squad received 3 months later than scheduled. Charlie Adam goes on to state on the promotion bonuses, saying, "The lads weren't on massive money, there were no win bonuses. If the club went up, it was going to receive £90 million, so we felt we were due a share of that. I think if we had said we wanted £10 million, Carl would have gone with it because he thought we were never going to get to the Premier League."
Yeah, and they signed off on £5 million and then they end up getting promoted. And then the Oystons make it as hard as possible for the players to get this money that they'd agreed to give them.
Whilst this situation was happening, it came to light that Carl Oyston had in fact paid himself £11 million director salary after Blackpool's promotion to the top flight. In fact, the largest director salary in the English football pyramid by some margin.
Completely insane. He's paid himself 11 million salary, and then Blackpool trying to fight relegation in January when they've still got a pretty good chance of staying up, really. Holloway has to sign a few players on loan, free transfers, while he's paying himself 11 million pounds. And the players that Holloway was able to bring in that season sort of reflect the lack of investment, really. You've got Kornilenko, Belarusian striker, coming from Russia, no Premier League experience, didn't really do a lot. Punchin, good signing, but then you've got like Andy Reid, James Beattie, wrong side of 30, and it's just, they're not players that are going to keep you in the division, no disrespect.
In contrast with Ian Holloway's transfer dealings, the club accounts stated in the same year the Oystons had taken out £23 million out of the club's coffers and put it into their own personal businesses. Blackpool even offered Liverpool legend Robbie Fowler £100 a week to play for the Seasiders, which of course he declined.
Of course he fucking did.
To add another nail to the firmly shut coffin that is Blackpool at this point, Ian Holloway, the legend that is, would leave the club for Crystal Palace in 2012. And by the 2013 season, Paul Ince was now the manager.
Yeah, for the pre-season of the 13-14 season, Inch had just 13 players in the squad, Tom Ince, his son, being one of them.
Of course.
The last of the Premier League era players had left or been sold, but Stephen Dobby did rejoin the club on loan from Palace.
Good servant for the club, for Blackpool.
Nottingham Forest arch enemy.
They did manage to get Ricardo Fuller, Nathan Delfonso for his second stint out of four at the club, and Michael Chopra in the squad for that season, though. Striker Michael Chopra voiced his opinion of training in an expletive-laden rant on social media in which he described how he turned up to training with just six other players.
God, it just sounds like an absolute circus at this point, doesn't it? But amazingly, after this essentially terrible preparations, by the sound of it, not great training, Blackpool win five of their first six games, but are knocked out of the League Cup by local rivals Preston.
Things seem to be going okay for Blackpool in this season, up until Paul Ince made a little bit of a fool of himself against Bournemouth, in which, as quoted from the BBC report, he was sent to the stands in the latter stages of the match after a bottle he threw inadvertently hit a female supporter. He was given a five-match stadium ban in which they didn't win a single game in that time.
Yes, this is like a precursor to then the disastrous season that it is. So there's like other highlights where Blackpool lose to Yeovil 1-0 with three players sent off within the last 5 minutes of the game, which they then follow that up incredibly with a 5-1 loss to Derby with two more players sent off.
What little momentum they had gained from that early spurt of form has clearly unravelled after this wild situation brought on by Paul Ince.
Yeah, the shocking stat. Like, you can't get a more awful run than this. They collected 4 points from a possible 48 over a 16-game period, which featured another 5-1 loss to Reading and a 4-0 loss to Watford.
Paul Ince, expectedly, was relieved of his duties in the January of that campaign and was replaced by player coach Barry Ferguson.
Barry Ferguson, Rangers legend. He kept them up by 3 points on the final day after losing 3-0 to Charlton, with other results going their way. He's quite brutal about how he kept them up and the kind of football they played, isn't he?
He went on to speak in the September of 2020 saying, "We weren't great to watch, we were shit to watch. We had to play a certain way, but you know what? I kept them up," which I can definitely feel a little bit of pride there from Barry Ferguson.
It's a huge achievement when you think of the chaos around the club at this point and that run they're on, when obviously everyone's heads must be so far down. It's a great achievement.
Charlton manager Jose Riga then joined the Seasiders after Barry Ferguson left at the end of the season, obviously. Weirdly enough, Jose Riga was the Charlton manager that inflicted the damage on the final day of the season against Barry Ferguson's Blackpool.
Yeah, and obviously Barry Ferguson, he's getting himself out of there, isn't he? He sees what's happening and
God knows why Jose Riga wants to jump into this ship, but hey, credit to him, I guess.
That same season, Owen and Carl Oyston had received around £600,000 in director salaries. This was more than the club's transfers that season and more than any other director in the Football League.
This is when the supporters ramped up the intensity on the owners with their bitterly fought Oyston out campaign.
And this saw the Oyston family refusing to honour players' contracts and many displays of public disrespect for the fans. The 13-14 season was when things really snapped and the fans actually stormed the director's box mid-game during a defeat to Derby.
Just 2 weeks later, the fans caused a temporary halt to their televised game against local rivals Burnley, throwing tennis balls onto the pitch in an attempt to take their frustrations to the wider audience on their television screens.
It's always tennis balls, isn't it?
But you don't want to hurt your players by throwing anything.
Obviously, it works and it caused a halt to the game. But I remember Hull City did this in the 90s, and it was 90s, 80s, because they were owned at this point by David Lloyd, who did these sports and tennis clubs. And it sort of had a meaning, like a link there.
Hmm. It's a nice middle ground, because again, not to repeat myself, but it's not the player's fault. A tennis ball ain't going to hit. I don't think a tennis ball's going to hit.
I'm not advocating let's throw loads of flares on or shooting an AK-47.
Mark, when you get the bricks out and throw it at Poor Michael Chopra.
I think Chopra would have preferred that to training, by the sound of it.
The board saw this as an opportunity to sell the upcoming 2014-15 season as the Riga Revolution, and many fans bought into it. That was until Riga's backroom staff began to work without official contracts.
One of them, Bart de Ruva, never even agreed terms and actually worked unpaid for a number of months as a favour to his friend Riga.
What a nice fella. The Seasiders were forced to cancel their Spanish pre-season training camp as they only had 8 players on the books.
Yeah, and only 10 days before the start of the season, the club still had no goalkeepers in the squad. And at the first game of the season, they could only actually name 4 substitutes because they'd forgotten to register the new signings.
Sounds very typical.
Absolute set of amateurs running riot at this club. It's just ridiculous.
Riga's tenure was a lost cause from the start, as you could tell. But at least he had some backing from the fans. They felt a connection as he challenged the ownership in his short tenure.
Yeah, which probably explains why the Oistons then offered his job to Gary Rowett, who was Burton manager at the time, while he was still in charge. And Rigorazzi was still in charge for another month.
And then weirdly, he was then replaced by Lee Clark instead. So they had four managers in 2014, which is in fact the same amount of wins they'd had in that time as well.
God. And Clark would resign shortly after the conclusion of the 14-15 season, with Blackpool being relegated to the third tier for the first time in 8 years.
If the football wasn't causing enough bad press, then Carl Oyston hitting the headlines for a text exchange with a fan in which he called the family retards in a bizarre outburst was never going to be good.
He's literally messaging and abusing fans now. It's crazy. In the same group of exchanges, he labelled himself on a never-ending nightmare revenge mission in his relation to his reign in charge of the club, which is, it's just so strange, isn't
it? It's getting more petty and more personal with every action he's doing as the years roll on for this club.
Yeah, and I don't think you can get any more childish when he turned up to a home game in his Range Rover with a registration plate that read Oyston out. Like, he's literally trying to incite his own fans at their own ground. I've just never known anything like it.
The fact there wasn't an article saying about how the Blackpool fans bottled that car to bits is beyond me. So I'd say that's quite good restraint from the Blackpool fans at this point.
God, yeah. You'd think all the windows would be through and it'd be on fire, wouldn't you? That was just crazy.
A week later, the new club secretary, Chris Howe, had to fill in as kit man after the youth team physio, who is also kit man, left the club. So we've got multiple jobs going on for multiple members of staff.
Yeah, and I'm imagining when Chris Howe, you know, I don't know, he found the job on LinkedIn as club secretary at Blackpool, he wasn't expecting to be washing people's shorts, was he?
Scrubbing boots.
Yeah. So by September 2015, Valerie Bellicon has finally opened his eyes and seen he's been taken for a ride by the Oistons. He starts legal action, alleging improper use of club funds.
Then came the straw that broke the camel's back, if it was not already broken. Owen and Carl Oyston opened legal proceeding against a number of fans for defamation in retaliation to numerous social media and supporter forum posts online.
He's literally trying to sue his own fans. It's not enough just abusing them, driving around in a car, like basically taking the piss out of them. He's now trying to sue them, which is crazy. And so one of the people he tries to sue was from the Blackpool Supporters Trust, who was a firmly anti-Oyston protester. And he also sued a lifelong fan and pensioner who had 30 Facebook friends. And this guy, this businessman, is suing them for spreading information about him and stuff.
Suing a pensioner for comments he made on his own personal social media.
To his 30 friends.
Supporters later rallied and incredibly raised 20k within a week to pay off the legal claims against this pensioner.
Yeah, and they also sued the honorary vice president of the Blackpool Supporters Trust, Tim Fielding, for remarks when he called them out as asset strippers, quite rightly. And they then sued him as well.
This name will come back to haunt them, however, the Oystons.
And in preparation for the final game of the season, supporters had been building up to a large-scale protest, and they wanted to put memorabilia around the statue of Stan Mortensen, our hero from earlier on in the podcast. And they actually let the club know months in advance about the protest. This is how petty, if they've not already proven it. He then had the statue of Stan Mortensen taken down due to safety measures. You just can't believe, like, every time you think they can't get any worse than this, they then get even worse.
The club's final game at home against Huddersfield was abandoned after fans invaded the pitch midway through the game. They refused to leave until the game was called off in protest before some fans tried to make their way up towards the director's box.
Things just keep sliding further and further down. So Neil McDonald was installed as the new manager in the summer of 2015, and he actually oversaw Blackpool's relegation to the bottom tier for the first time in 15 years in his one season in charge. So the club really has now sank to the very bottom of the Football League now.
This toxic atmosphere around the club led to promotion-winning legend Brett Ormerod not holding his testimonial at Bloomfield Road.
Yeah, he said it broke his heart to not have it there, but the atmosphere was just too toxic. Carl Oyston had offered him the stadium, but he snubbed it in favour of AFC Fylde's new £18 million Mill Farm Stadium.
He goes on to state, "With fans banned from Bloomfield Road and others refusing to step foot inside, I couldn't have held it there. It would have stirred up a hornet's nest and I would have been dragged into the criticism. I didn't want people saying I was siding with the Oystons. This isn't a political statement. I don't want the politics anywhere near the day."
It's really sad for Ormerod and the fans as well. The fans who'd want to thank him for his service over two spells at the club. And Ormerod who'd want to sort of say goodbye to the fans. It's pretty sad.
His lasting note saying, "With all that's going on and all the negativity around the place, I don't want to spoil what should be a celebration for everyone."
You know, the fans really showed how serious, how fed up they were of this situation when the club actually reached the League Two player final in 2017, and a lot of the fans boycotted the game.
As mentioned before, honorary vice president Tim Fielding explains the weird scenario surrounding that final. The scenario of wanting to support the team and wanting the best for your team, but wondering if it's actually the best thing you can do to get promoted. It's a difficult time to be a Blackpool fan.
This is the thing, they want to starve the owners of money so they don't want to stay, which might make them leave faster. But if Blackpool get promoted, they're going to get more TV money, more away fans, more money. And it's a tough one. Like, obviously, you always want your club to do well, but if losing this playoff final meant they would go, like, obviously, this is the angle they have.
When you've got your own fans rooting against the team, I think that's just the final thing that states how awful the situation's got.
Like you say, it's such a tough one for the fans because they never, you don't want to wish bad on your club, but it's almost for the greater good, isn't it, to get rid of them. But they would actually win that game 2-1 and they would go on to be promoted to League One, but in front of a crowd of just 24,000 at Wembley.
This game versus Exeter City featured a young Ollie Watkins as well.
The biggest celebrations would be for what actually happened the next winter off the field. In November of 2017, Owen and Carl were found in a High Court judgment to have operated illegitimate stripping of Blackpool FC, paying £26 million out of the club to companies they owned.
The court found that Oyston and his son had abused their majority shareholding position at the club in a manner that was detrimental to both the business and Bellacon.
They were subsequently ordered to pay £31 million to buy out Bellacon's share of the business, of which £25 million, along with other costs, was still owed.
This is where the fans start to get their first bit of leverage in getting this awful family out of their club. The club supporters were hopeful that the amount set by the High Court would be so high that the Oyston family would be forced to sell their interest.
A few days after the court decision, on the 10th of November, the Oystons decided to put the club up for sale, and this is a huge landmark moment for the fans.
Celebrations. Following further legal action by Bellacon to obtain payment from the Oystons, on the 13th of February 2019, the High Court appointed a receiver and removed Oyston from the board of Blackpool Football Club. Hallelujah.
What a moment, like what a moment. Which comes back also that getting him out the door, like Bellacon was fooled in there and he's been key in the end to getting them out because he was owed that much money from them.
You got to think when he was the one putting the money for the stands, helping Charlie Adam come to the club, and in fact then removing Oyston. Bellacon has got to be a cult hero down at the Seasiders.
We're saying this though, Blackpool fans, please let us know your opinion of Bellacon. Like, we couldn't really find much in our research.
Blackpool fans were jubilant and a return was planned for boycotting fans on the 9th of March 2019 when the club was due to host Southend at Bloomfield Road. Thousands were expected to pack the stadium for the first time in over 4 years.
The huge, huge day, 13th of January 2019, I'm sure there must be a Blackpool fan somewhere with this date tattooed on them, at least one. 13th of June 2019, 49-year-old local businessman Simon Sadler is announced as the club's new owner, ending the Oyston's 32-year tenure.
Following that, on the 5th of July in 2019, Terry McPhillips resigned as Blackpool manager. However, the way he ended up in that role is a wild ride in itself.
Yeah, so McPhillips had actually followed Gary Bowyer when he came to Blackpool as manager, as both chief scout and assistant manager, which seems like quite a wild combo anyway, doesn't it?
More doubling up on roles here at Blackpool.
Yeah. And he was appointed as caretaker manager in August 2018 when Gary Bowyer left. And he was made the permanent manager in the following September. But he actually resigned because he informed the club's board that he had no long-term desire to actually be a manager. Which I do wonder what he said in his interview to land himself in this position as manager, but he didn't really want to be manager.
And then having the honesty to be able to just go, I don't want to be here anymore. Yeah.
Can I leave? Yeah, it's a strange one.
However, he was succeeded by someone much more fitting for the role as Simon Grayson returned to Blackpool after leaving the role 11 years ago for Leeds United.
Yeah, and you can see what Simon Sadler potentially tried to do with this one is bring back some of the glory days. You know, Grayson was sort of there when this journey began on the upward rise to the Premier League.
However, the Blackpool fans didn't want to let him forget about how he'd left the club, stating, "Even this year coming back to Blackpool, where I started out coaching in 2005 and where things have gone well for me second time round, I've had so many people making the point to remind me I resigned to leave for Leeds and that I later then managed local rivals Preston for 4 years. They won't forget, and so you aren't allowed to forget either."
Yeah.
Simon Grayson tried to inject some positivity back to the Lancashire club. Despite within these positive comments, there is still the sobering reality for so many Blackpool fans, as he goes on to celebrate the fact that they have four groundsmen and that they're on the up again.
Yeah, and he also spoke about how lots of people have actually left behind the scenes, come back to the club since Simon Sadler is in charge, and speaks about how their new chief executive, Ben Mansford, actually left Maccabi Tel Aviv to come there, swapping one seaside resort for another.
And then finishing off with, there's that much positivity around this place.
Yeah. And for the first game of the season against Bristol Rovers, they actually had 11,000 fans in the ground, which is complete contrast to those last couple of years under the Oystons. In the crowd also it included David Moyes and Mark Lawrenson, who actually came to watch the game. And they commented on the atmosphere and saying, you know, this is the reconnection between the town and the football club. They've got their club back.
Mark Lawrenson even said, wow, the crowd, they don't half back their team.
Despite Grayson's pre-season positivity, just 6 months into the season, he was fired.
And was replaced by former Liverpool under-23 manager Neil Critchley, who became the club's 38th full-time manager in its 132-year history.
Klopp described Critchley's surprise move to Blackpool as a great thing.
Going on to add, we wanted to have the best people here in all departments. That means there are some requests, and hopefully more in the future, from other clubs. That's exactly how it should be. We don't want to have someone here for 20 years doing the same job.
It's that question you always get on Football Manager when like your assistant manager gets linked with like a job like Gillingham or something, and they always ask, are you happy about this? Like, I'm pleased for the guy, you know, it shows we're doing the right thing, but I can tell Klopp has played a lot of Football Manager.
Taking the moral high ground.
Yeah. Critchley's first season in charge would be cut short by the COVID-19 pandemic. Blackpool would finish in 13th position when the table was amended on a points per game ratio.
And coming up to the very present season, Neil Critchley's first full season as Blackpool manager saw their fourth consecutive season in League One, the third tier of English football.
Critchley actually was joined by Mike Garrity as assistant manager, also leaving Liverpool. He'd actually worked in their academy since 2007, so you can see how they've shaped the squad with like young, exciting, up-and-coming players. They've got a lot of experience dealing with young players and high-quality players coming through Liverpool's academy.
You can see this as Blackpool ended up beating Premier League side West Bromwich Albion on penalties in the third round of the FA Cup, giving the Seasiders their first FA Cup win over top-flight opposition since they beat Burnley 45 years prior.
Yeah, and the FA Cup run was ended at the fourth round stage against Brighton when they lost 2-1. But the Tangerines were without five first-team players after they tested positive for COVID.
On the time of recording, Blackpool are sitting pretty in fifth place just inside the playoff spots.
Yeah, fresh after recording a 4-1 victory over Gillingham, which included a great team goal, which was finished off by Sully Kaikai. Great goal.
We were saying about how it's glad they don't have that pitch that they had in the Premier League season when they're trying to play this lovely, silky, smooth football, because it just wouldn't have happened with that pitch there.
Yeah, a proper team. I don't know how many passes it was, but you couldn't have done that on the old Bloomfield Road pitch. The game also includes two goals for Jerry Yates, who's actually now the third top goal scorer in the division, and he's the first Blackpool player to hit 20 in a season since Andy Morrell in the 06-07 season.
This extended their unbeaten run to 13 games with just one loss in their last 17, and unbeaten against league leaders Hull with one win and one draw.
You can definitely draw some similarities to the Premier League promotion season to this season, where Blackpool have gone this fantastic late charge, this late push. I don't know about you, but since recording the podcast, I find myself every week I'm looking out for Blackpool's results, I'm watching the highlights, checking in how they're doing, and this run they're on is incredible, and I really don't hope we curse anything here, and I hope they get a playoff position.
Adding to the excitement of their current position in the table, Blackpool also boast a young and exciting team. This is a great indicator of their turnaround in fortunes, as Premier League clubs are now trusting Blackpool with the development of their young talents, like Ellis Sims on loan from Everton, Daniel Ballard on loan from Arsenal, Ben Woodburn was on loan from Liverpool but was recalled after an injury.
Yeah, and like you say, it's a great validation of what Critchley's trying to do at Blackpool and the position the club's in now. The fact that Arsenal are trusting the development of Daniel Ballard to Blackpool, to Critchley. Yeah, it's just a great seal of approval on what they're trying to do. The way Critchley's trying to play football is very much based on the methods of Klopp, with emphasis of playing from the back. A tricky start to the season where they lost six of their first nine league matches, but on the form they're on now, you can see that everybody's really bought into his ideas.
Even Daniel Ballard himself states how much of a good fit Blackpool was when it came around as an opportunity to go there on loan.
And hopefully what we're witnessing about right now is the start of another resurgence at Blackpool under new ownership, with fans in the stadium. Hopefully with a new stadium or improved stadium, new training ground. I think this could be the start of something really good.
To conclude, we have a great quote from Blackpool fan Ashik once again, stating, "As a Blackpool fan in 2021, the future is looking very bright, as the majority of our fan base would agree."
They've got a new owner in who's a Blackpool fan himself, passionate about the town, passionate about the club, but also like the community aspects around it. So I think everything's completely different. I managed to speak to a couple of Blackpool fans on their forums. One of the ones was like, "How would you compare the atmosphere under the Oystons to the atmosphere now under Simon Sadler?" About three or four people just said there's no words to describe the difference.
Ash also goes on to state, "We have a young and very talented group of players that are now under the guidance of Neil Critchley. He's been given a chance by Simon Sadler to build the club in his image, which is a breath of fresh air for the Blackpool fans."
He summarises the mood of Blackpool at the moment with one word: optimistic. I really do hope this is a resurgence and a climb back up the divisions for Blackpool.
I think that term optimistic is the summarising word for the entirety of Blackpool now at the moment.
It does feel like a weight has been lifted, a cloud from the club. It's great. And I hope we've done you justice, Blackpool fans.
Pereira still has to score. Maxwell saves. And Blackpool are through. His third save in the shootout. And Pereira, who'd scored in normal time, is denied in the shootout. And the Premier League side go out. Blackpool win 3-2 on penalties.
And that brings us to the end of our first episode here on the Journeyman Podcast, talking about Blackpool Football Club.
Yeah, and please get in touch with us. Let us know if you enjoyed it. Let us know your Blackpool stories and any suggestions of clubs you want to see us feature next.
We just want to see your input in the comments. Please make sure to rate and share this podcast with all your friends, as everything you do can help the podcast grow.
And now something we want to become a bit of a tradition on the podcast is now our obscure link to the next club we're going to cover. But we'll give you a little clue now, see if anyone can work it out. But yeah, follow our social media for more clues. Yeah, so Barry Bannon, who played 20 games during the Premier League promotion season for Blackpool and actually came off the bench for 2 minutes in the playoff final, made his professional debut for Aston Villa in a UEFA Cup group match in December 2008 against our next chosen club, when he was brought on as a substitute in the 61st minute.
Who is that club? Let us know on social media if you can figure it out, and we'll make sure to shout you out on our next episode. So apart from that, I think from both of us, we both just say thank you once again and goodbye for everyone here at the Journeyman Podcast.
See you next time.